I looked at those honors. I'm actually too tired to give this lecture, so are there any questions? Okay. Pauline, thank you very much. Very kind, and also thank your students for wasting their time. I'm going to talk exclusively about antibody libraries today. And I find in general that the audience, some are know more about it than I do, and for some it's a new subject. And so to those who are well-versed in the subject, I apologize in advance for telling you some things you may know already. And the only thing I can offer to you is the fact that I will try and give my point of view, and perhaps there's some insight as to why certain things are the way they are, were done in the way they were. And to those of you who are not familiar with antibody libraries, I hope you will gain some ideas and perhaps some inspiration from what I'm about to tell you. Now, if you look at this first slide, where is it? Top one, thank you. It's immunology, especially immunochemistry, is about 100 years old. Oh, I see. Okay. And much has happened since this wonderful drawing by Ehrlich, in which he depicted how he thought the immune system was organized, particularly antibodies, in his famous side chain theory. And this is the antibody molecule based on X-ray crystallographic evidence that we understand today. And much has happened in this general arena over the last 100 years. But there was one thing that Ehrlich dreamed of that actually hadn't happened as of 20 years ago. And that's this. Can we make it? maybe we can make it a little louder. I think it's. Canada, that's it. Okay. Well, basically, what you see here is Paul Ehrlich asking the finance minister for money. And what he's asking for the money for is he's saying that someday we will be able to manufacture in a test tube more magic bullets than you could imagine. And under the genre of nothing changes, the finance minister tells him, I cannot go to a budget committee with a silly idea like that. and when just to tell you, when the first antibody libraries were developed, I have a letter, I won't tell you who wrote it to me, it was an industrial sponsor who, after the paper was published in Science Magazine in 1989, sent me a letter saying that basically this was yet another example of how he wasted their money. And that at any rate, antibodies would never be drugs. And if they were to be drugs, we certainly didn't want them inside bacteria, right? So the idea, somewhat romantic idea, of making antibodies in the test tube without the use of live animals is, in a sense, the subject of the talk today. So as I mentioned, it took 100 years, and then there was an explosion in technologies geared at manufacturing the immune system, copying the repertoire, expanding the repertoire in a test tube by genetic methodology without any need to use living animals. All of you have the capacity, clonal capacity, each one of you, to make 10 to the 8th different antibody molecules in your body. A good antibody library today is not worth its salt unless it's three orders of magnitude larger than that. And most commercial libraries have on the order of 10 to the 11th members. Today, I don't know if this is an exact number, it's changing every day. There are about 25 antibodies in clinical practice for a wide variety of diseases. As Pauline mentioned, Humira. Humira is an antibody against tumor necrosis factor. It sells in the neighborhood of $5 billion a year. But more importantly, many people can actually literally leave their wheelchairs because of that therapy. There are over 350 antibody therapies in clinical trials. If you pick up BioWorld as such a publication, you'll find a new one every day. And every big pharma, and now every small pharma, has an antibody effort. So there's a big, big difference. Now, why exactly did this field explode? And mind you, there was not a single therapeutic antibody in the marketplace as of 1995. And the reason was very simple, that the new immunochemistry, and I mean that broadly, allowed a chemical solution to the diversity problem. As long as you only had, as it were, an animal solution to the problem, for many, many reasons, it was not possible to make therapeutic antibodies. Not the least of which, you came across the problem of tolerance, immune tolerance. And, of course, if you made an antibody in a mouse, it would be immediately rejected by the host organism. The issue of tolerance, a lot of people don't think about it very often. But except for one antibody to respiratory syncytial virus, you have to imagine, remember, that every therapeutic antibody in the marketplace today is antibody to self and therefore an autoimmune reactivity. And therefore, you are, for the most part, tolerant to these kinds of antibodies. Now, as it emerged, the centerpiece of the new immunochemistry is the antibody library. And as I told you, an antibody library in broad outline is a collection of antibodies in a few microliters that exceeds your repertoire by about 1,000-fold. Now, why? What was the driving force? If we only knew five targets, we wouldn't need an antibody library as such. But there were many driving forces, not the least of which is that we now have access to very, very large antigenic space. And every time a new piece of biology, extracellular biology for the most part, is discovered, there are those who would like to make an antibody therapeutic against it, either to get rid of it, to stimulate it, to give it a longer half-life, or whatever. So as the knowledge goes, so goes the antigenic space. This in turn, of course, necessitates the requirement for very large numbers of antibodies. And you, for the most part, don't want simply an antibody to something. You want a collection of antibodies, a collection of affinities, a collection of antibodies to various regions of the protein or small molecule in some cases. You want sometimes a conformationally dependent antibody, sometimes otherwise. And therefore, you need the numbers. And we did it in part because of a new catalyst, which I won't talk about today. Now, what are the features of the antibody library that fulfill the needs of the driving force? Every technological development in science has a driving force to which it more or less fulfills the needs. Well, first of all, the library methodology allows one to create what is literally an artificial immune system and with unlimited diversity. Now, I use the word unlimited in inverted commas because if it gets too big, it exceeds your ability to access the library. And so the limit today is 10 to the 11th, 10 to the 12th members. But for the most part, 90-plus percent of things that you use the library to find, you can get out of a library that has 10 to the 11th or 10 to the 12th members. Most importantly, the library will show you a large number of chemical solutions to a binding problem. If you make 3 monoclonal antibodies to something in a mouse, you have 3 antibodies to the object, but you don't have enough information from the sequence, if you can get it. Of course, nowadays you can. To understand what is the chemical nature of the binding. And as you'll see in a moment, that becomes very important. And the reason you can do that, and I'll come to this, is because if you have in front of you a display of chemical solutions to a binding problem, you can look for what we call a jackpot or the chemical consensus. Keep in mind the idea of the jackpot. Keep in mind the idea of a chemical consensus, because when you get one of those, you understand in a very deep way about the binding energy of the antibody. Now, I put this little jackpot up here because somebody told me that in Europe they don't know what a jackpot is, and so I don't believe that, but just in case, it's a Las Vegas device to separate you from your money. And it's very successful. And ultimately, library methodology allows antibodies to be treated in the same way as small molecules. All right, so how do you create an artificial immune system? Well, everybody in this room has probably cloned something. And a cloning event is an event in which you take a mixture and reduce it to a singularity. If you think about what you do in the laboratory in cloning, that's what you do. When you make an antibody library, it's the opposite. You start with clones, and you ruin it. You mix them all up, and then the trick is to get them back as clones. So schematically, the requirement is it must be clonal. If you have an antibody library and you have no methodology to return it to clonality, then it is not worth anything. You must have very, very large numbers for the reasons we discussed, and they must be equal or greater to than the natural repertoire. And most importantly, you must link recognition and replication. Those two items must be in a singular package. And nowadays, this is a given, but one thing you need, just for completeness sake, is a way to increase the binding energy. Because many times, the antibody comes out nanomolar. And nowadays, with some of the targets that one is after, one needs picomolar or better. Just to give you a benchmark, in general, if you make an antibody to a protein in an animal, carbohydrate, it will be worse. You call it a good day if you make a nanomolar antibody. In library methodology, if you can't get picomolar, it's not a good day. And why that is, one could spend an hour on. But basically, the limitation of anti-protein antibody in an animal, as I say, is nanomolar. In the library work, it's picomolar. The highest binding energy antibody I know of is an anti-fluorescein antibody, the so-called 4-4-4-4-0 antibody. It's 10 to the minus 14th. So that's the range you can generally access. All right, so the clonal immune system, as I mentioned to you, is clonal. That means, of course, everybody in this room knows this, that there's been a very sophisticated packaging event, and every member of the repertoire is contained ultimately in its own package. And so when an immune response is called up, something wrong here? I know why, because what I see on the screen you don't see, right? it doesn't matter. A lot of little antibodies down here. And what happens is the progeny of each package is ultimately made as a singularity. So you take clones, and you go from clones to clones. Now, in the antibody library, it's the opposite. You take this lovely clonal system where everything is perfectly packaged, and you just tear the packages apart. And now, everybody is scrambled. So nobody is like they were to start with, right? And we'll come to why that works, in fact. And one of the early arguments in antibody libraries was, what good is it? You ruin the original pairs. And we've had this lovely packaging system. We had all the original pairs all lined up, and now you went ahead and ruined them. So there were two problems that surfaced immediately when one wanted to clone the antibody repertoire. And because of this problem, because of these problems, all the early cloning events were one chain. Because the two-chain problem and the problem of the so-called original pairs was thought to be formidable. Second problem was, how are you going to link recognition and replication in a package? Why did you need to do that? Because you needed to get back to the clonality that you disrupted in the first place. So the entire repertoire problem, and I'm trying to give you sort of generalities, and if you need later any specifics, happy to give them, and I will come to some in a moment. In the field, people talked about the frequency problem, particularly the late Cesar Millstein. And the problem went something like this. We have 10 to the 8th clones in our body. If we were to take them apart, now we're talking early 90, right? Take them apart and put them back together, 10 to the 8th heavies, 10 to the 8th lights, 10 to the 16 combinations. Now, the best anybody thought one could do with methodology in those days was to fish out maybe 1 in 10 to the 8th. So 10 to the 8th was a very, very big, very big number. And so why would you make all these combinations to get one antibody? If you did that, you know, it wasn't worth the thing. It turned out, and I think anybody who'd worked with proteins, Raymond, you knew this, I'm sure, that the heavy chain, light chain pairing is exceedingly degenerate. Now, you knew that if you thought about it for a while from the sequence, because there's more heavy chain genes in our germlines than there are light chains. So obviously, a light chain can service many heavy chains. But those of us who came from the protein side of the business had for years been shuffling heavy chains and light chains. And one knew that the frequency problem was not a real problem, and that one light chain would service very, very many heavy chains. But most importantly, and this is what was missed, and let me say it in a sentence, is you don't want the original pairs in a therapeutic sense, because the original pairs cause the limitation of tolerance. And since all therapeutic antibodies, except those against infectious disease, will be autoimmune and antibody to self, in reality, it's the non-original pairs you're after, not the original pairs. So if you look here at a makeshift library, then my slide would have 10 heavies and 10 lights, 100 members. These are the original pairs. So 10% of the library is original pairs. That means 1 out of 10 would be the original pairs. And these are the unoriginal pairs off the diagonal. For the most part, these are not interesting. These are who you want. Now, how do you link recognition and replication? Simply put, you use a microorganism or ribosomes, spores, whatever you like. The essential feature is that the genes that encode the antibody of interest are on the inside, or sometimes expressed in a plaque, as in lambda phage, like this, and the protein is expressed on the outside. So in the library of 10 to the 11th members, you have, let's say in the M13 case, you have 10 to the 11th genes in a plasmid, a phagemid, inside the tube of the phage, and the antibody molecule that is encoded by that gene is on the outside. So here is the one that we devised with Carlos Barbas, and what you see here, and I'll show you a picture of that in a second, is you have the life cycle of a phage. This is a phagemid and a helper, and you have basically a vector that is putting the heavy chain and the light chain in the periplasmic space. They're assembling in a way I'll show you in a moment on the tip of the virus particle, and the gene that encodes this particular heavy and light chain is on the inside of the virus particle. And therefore, the gene that encodes it and the protein it expresses are in one package, and you have taken that bloody mixture you made in the first place and have returned it to clonality, although this time not in a cell, but in a phage molecule. So this is just a vector. There are many, many kinds of vectors. We won't go into that. And this is what it looks like. And I think this picture is worth perhaps all the words. Here's a phage, phage. It's basically a micron long. It's got, it's a tube. It's made out of 2,700 copies of a so-called gene 8 protein. And on the tip of that phage is an antibody molecule. And this particular phage happens to be against hepatitis B virus. And so the little circles you see are the hepatitis B virus core, and you see how the phage attaches. So imagine that you've got 10 to the 11th of these phage, all of which carry a different antibody on the surface as an assay vehicle. Now, once they're cloned, of course, every phage carries the same antibody on its surface and the gene that encodes that antibody on the inside. So what are the main technical features and conceptual ideas that underlie antibody libraries? First of all, you no longer require immunization. You have a bottle that you go to time and time again in a process called panning to fish out an antibody to whatever you wish. Phage are very robust. Either these phage or lambda, and you can do lots and lots of things. You can pan an organic solvent. You can pan an EDTA if you like. You can do all kinds of things the mouse would never or rat would never allow you to do. Most importantly, again, you're not limited by tolerance, and you don't have to use anything. Since you don't have to use anything that's natural if you don't wish, you're not limited to natural molecules. And most importantly, I suppose, is you can harvest antibodies from man. And so you can go to a person and get all the antibodies you want by the same methodology. There is this concept of the fossil record. And that means that since this technology is nucleic acid based, you have a record in your body of every antibody you ever made, whether you're making it at present or not. And so if one goes to a person and makes an antibody library from that person, you have in the bottle a record of any antibody that person has ever made, and you can fish that out independent of any serology. Think for a moment, at the risk of going too long, of what is serology in reality, right? And what does serology mean, and what's the difference here? Serology comes from a time when if you wanted to know whether somebody was exposed to an agent, like influenza virus or plague or whatever, you would go to the serum and you would ask the question, does this person have increasing titer of antibody to object X? And if the person had increasing titer of antibody to object X, that would mean there was a recent exposure. This technology, the kinetics are not important. You can get, of course, antibody to object X if the person is making antibody currently, but if the person made an antibody to something 50 years ago, that memory lives and you can get it out again. And that turns out to be important in certain issues. Most importantly, this allows you to to get antibodies to very, very rare specificities. As you'll see, particularly in the case of influenza, which I'll show you toward the end, sometimes the most important antibodies from the point of view of virus neutralization, for instance, are present at very, very low concentration in the order of 1 in 10 to the 8th. So if you did classic serology or you made hybridomas, you would never, never reach deeply enough into the repertoire to find these. And it sort of goes in a curious way. Anything that's any good is rare, basically, right? And what we're finding time and time again is the immune repertoire has vast riches after exposure to infectious disease. But more often than not, these riches are not evident at the level of the bulk. All right, so what is the meaning? How does one think about this conceptually? What people do these days, if they're not interested in disease or they don't want to go to man, make what I'm showing you on this slide, you can't see at the top, but what we call synthetic antibodies. And basically what we do is we just synthesize the six CDRs of the antibody molecule by genetic means. And of course, now you can have any number you wish. You could have as many antibodies as the stars. And you make what we call a synthetic library. Now, a synthetic library simply means that you made up the CDRs. They did not come from any natural source, and they have no basis in reality, historical reality, either in terms of length of the CDR or amino acid composition. Now, let's look at this one, and you may find this one not interesting. And this is antibodies to metals. But it's going to allow me to make a general point that I think you may find interesting. So metals are not immunogenic. If you were to take a piece of copper, you take a piece of iron, you take a piece of iron oxide, nobody ever immunized, as far as I know, to iron oxide or copper. But a synthetic library can be panned against such a thing. Now, here's a case where antibody libraries were panned against these metals, chelated, so the coordination sites of these metals were open. Now, if you look at this slide and you look at these sequences of just the heavy chains here, you would not see anything that would jump to your eye and say, gee, I understand the chemical basis of binding here. But if you were an inorganic chemist, you would. And if you look at copper over here, you would see these histidines. And you would say, oh, I understand that histidine is a copper-going ligand. Those nitrogens on the imidazole ring are used in the coordination sphere, and therefore I understand now why these antibodies bind to copper. But that would be a knowledge-based conclusion. You would come to that conclusion because of your understanding of inorganic chemistry. The sequence by itself did not tell you the answer immediately because no two sequences are the same. And therefore, you cannot read the sequence and get the chemical answer without information content. So you have a large number of chemical solutions to the problem. This is what the antibody did for you in order to bind copper, but you don't know why. Now, contrast this. You can't see the top of this slide. But what this slide says is what is the meaning of a jackpot and consensus. And we're going to understand that now by making antibody to magnetite. Magnetite is this. It's one of the most abundant forms of iron on Earth. Magnetite is iron oxide. I don't imagine any immunologist injected this stuff like that into a rabbit. And Lord knows immunologists have injected everything possible into rabbit, but never this. So the idea of making antibodies to crystals like this is not in the wheelhouse of most immunologists. But, of course, in library work, it doesn't matter because you're just going to pan against it. So here is a set of antibodies that were made against magnetite. Panned against magnetite. This is what we call a jackpot, and this is what we call a jackpot. Why is it a jackpot? Well, it is because the repertoire you have in your test tube has 10 to the 8th different sequences. And there's no probability to speak of that you would get the same antibody twice unless it was correct, unless there was some reason for that. So here you got the same antibody three times. Here you got it twice. So you have a jackpot. You have pretty strong inclination that the experiment is correct. That is, these are good antibodies. But you don't know why. However, now you get a consensus sequence. These are the required sequences, and you begin to understand why this is working, because chemically speaking, you need the ARG, Sear, Lys, ARG, Gly, ARG. So in other words, that is the chemical region of that antibody that is binding. Now the other thing you see very often is what we call convergent evolution. And here, of course, you see another consensus, because these are, again, you see the ARG-ARG requirement. Now, interestingly enough, another group using E. coli alone made some mutants of the Lambe loop, right? And can you see that? Yes, and you see this? They got the same sequence we got. So basically, this particular sequence is now known. It wasn't known at the time. Is what the magnetic bacteria use to bind iron. So the number of antibody molecules was powerful enough to give you a chemical answer to the binding of iron that is used in nature, at least in the binding of magnetite in a biological sense. So access to very large numbers of antibodies allows you, can't see it, but what it says is it allows you assessment of chemical solutions to a binding problem. In other words, as Raymond wrote recently in PNAS, the numbers are very important. This is a numbers game, and the numbers are critical, right? The important features are the jackpot, the consensus, and often convergent evolution. And most importantly, and the reason why I went through all of this is because these sort of concepts were revealed with very simple antigens. There cannot be anything simpler than copper 2. Ordinarily, you would not even think of it as an antigen. It's an antigen, it's not an immunogen, okay? But you're going to see these again now when we come to really important antibodies. So the principles of jackpot, consensus, and convergent evolution, although one in very simple systems, are quite general. Let's talk about Humira. Humira was made by what I call my great-grandfather's axe problem. I think that's a, pardon me, Raymond, I think that's a Cambridge term, actually. What it actually means is the Cambridge, like Oxford, is so steeped in history, they often talk about their great-grandfather's axe for which the father changed the blade and the grandfather changed the handle, right? But it's still, you know, the great-grandfather's axe. And that's how Humira was made, basically, right? Humira was the ultimate library drill. And what it was, basically, is one took a mouse antibody over here. This antibody is worth nothing, zero. This antibody is worth $5 billion. Okay. How do you go from zero to five billion? Basically, what you do is you basically keep this heavy chain constant. You pan against a library of light chains. then you throw away the heavy chain, and you, the whole thing is a templated approach. Now, the reason Umero was made that way was basically because in those days, the libraries were smaller. Today, you wouldn't do that. Today, you would go directly to attend the 12th library. You would pull it out straight away, and off you'd go toward your billion. At that time, however, the libraries were more limited, and therefore, it was necessary, I believe, to bootstrap up a little bit. But it's a really interesting drill how you could use a mouse antibody as a template to ultimately make a human antibody. And this is why it's my great-grandfather's axe problem, because my grandfather changed the handle and my father changed the blade. But in the end of the day, it came from the mouse antibody. Now, I talked to you a little bit, you can see, about the fossil record. Fossil record means that if I could entice you and sit outside with a syringe, if you would give me a little blood, sometimes a little bone marrow, I could get every antibody you've ever made. The fossil record becomes very important when you want a rare antibody. And let me show you one case quickly. I don't know how much of this you can see. This is a case where what one wanted was an antibody that only bound to metastatic breast cancer cells and not cancer cells that didn't metastasize. And so basically one, without showing you too much detail, one panned against a library of cells that always metastasized. But first, you panned against cells that never metastasized. And anybody who bound to a cancer cell that never metastasized was thrown out, and the leftovers were then panned against a cell that always metastasized. And there was something, and this is what made me think about saying what I said to you earlier, Pauline. There was something really strange about these antibodies. And it was that they would not bind without divalent cation. And that was the clue. And it turns out that you see here, if you, again, you can't see the scale, but what it is, yellow is calcium, in the presence of calcium 2. And you see what it is these antibodies bind to the activated integrin, alpha V beta 3, and will not bind unless there's calcium. Now, the reason I spent some time early on in what probably bored the hell out of you talking about antibodies to copper, because I wanted to bring up the concept of convergent evolution. When you start to play with these big numbers, you're almost playing in the sphere of evolution itself, right? And the bigger the numbers, the more you're playing in that sphere. And you can see the best fits. And it turns out that evolution in the alpha V beta 3 has invented RGD. So the RGD motif is very, very important in the binding in the integrin field, especially alpha V beta 3. When the sequence of this antibody, this rare antibody, was done, look what it has. It has RGD. So it converged upon nature's own selection method. And to make a long story short, you need that RGD sequence in order to bind. So it's the ultimate example of convergent evolution, where an antibody molecule converged to a normal receptor ligand situation. Now, the interesting thing here is that in the ligand-integrin reaction, it occurred in biological evolution. It took you about 1 million years or more. Who knows? This evolution took about 3 weeks in the test tube. So truly, it is a sort of test tube evolution event. So evolution selected the RGD ligand interaction for recognition. The surprise is that antibodies choose the same recognition event. But antibody could have chosen any region of the integrin antigen, but it chose the RGD site. Interestingly enough, once that site was chosen, it could have recognized it in any way, but it chose RGD. I'm not going to go through all the biology that's published because I want to show you something else. I want to show you another example now, a very recent example. A lot of the things I told you now were old, older, okay? They were from earlier this year. Now I'd like to come to something more recent and perhaps more timely. Part of this is what we did, and the most interesting part others have done. There appeared in Turkey an outbreak of avian influenza virus in children. And 12 children were involved in this Turkish cluster. 6 children died. So this was a very serious epidemic in these children in Turkey. And to those of you who are clinically inclined, this x-ray tells the story. They died of massive pneumonia and a cytokine storm, basically. So this was a very serious disease in these children. Now, we were able to get into Turkey and get bone marrow from those children to make antibody libraries. And just as a technical aside, and something which I would have never believed, but in fact is true, and it's a sort of a testimony to modern industry, there is a solution called RNA later. And you can take RNA from anywhere right now, dump it into RNA later, in this case, get through Turkey's customs, get through Turkey's import, sit in the airport, right? Miss a flight, so on and so forth. It's a remarkable, probably salt, but anyway, thing. So anyway, made this thing, and then we're able to pan this library, you don't need to see these sequences, against hemagglutinin. In the blue, you see mutations we called required. These are mutations you had to have in order to be a good binder or a neutralizer. In red are dominant mutations, and then in white are sequences you found necessary to bind to a different virus. Now, when we saw these sequences from these children, we reported something which we thought was pretty unusual. First of all, they used the same germline gene, the VH169 germline. On the average, that particular germline is about 1% of the 1% of the VH germlines, and therefore you would expect that if there's something random going on here, it ought to be 2% or less. So we reported that here were the sequences that these children used. These particular antibodies were unheard of because they were broadly neutralizing. They neutralized all the way back to 1918, and they were unusual antibodies. But then this year, something extraordinary happened. So this was that paper published in 08. There then appeared three papers based on two separate libraries. One was a library from so-called naive patients. There is probably no such thing, by the way, when you talk about influenza, made in Boston. So somebody made a combinatorial antibody library from people in Boston, and at the frequency of about 1 in 10 to the 8th, they got some antibodies out. Then the Crucell company, very interested in the influenza vaccine, particularly passive antibody, they made a combinatorial antibody library from people they'd vaccinated. They also got interesting antibodies at a frequency of about 1 in 10 to the 8th. So these same kind of rare antibodies. If you take a look at all these libraries, you can't see it, but this is the same slide I showed you before. On the top are the sequences of ours. The slide is constructed to show you how many more we did than they did. Okay. And the bottom are the sequences from the other two groups. And basically, the answer is, if you could read this, everybody got the same antibodies. So if you go to Turkey and you get children who recover from infection, you go to Boston, you get Red Sox fans. You go to the Netherlands and you get hopes for big dollars. You still make the same antibodies. Now, Ian Wilson, behalf of people in his group, and Marisco on behalf, Ian and Crusell, and Ian and Crusell and Marisco and the Boston crowd solved the structures. And as you might expect, all the antibodies are basically the same. And what they do is very remarkable. And that is, as many of you may know, most antibodies in influenza bind to this globular head. And that's the reason that the influenza virus escapes, because it can change the sequence up there, especially in these loops, or it can cover these critical epitopes with carbohydrate. These library-derived rare antibodies bind actually down here to the fusion region of the virus, and they prevent the virus from undergoing the fusion function, springing open and doing the fusion sequence that allows it to escape the infected cell. So where do these antibodies come from? Why should it be that in repertoires as diverse as this, three separate groups get the same antibody? Well, nobody really knows, except to say that there's very likely an SOS component of the immune response. And what I mean by that basically is that in the case of these children had 3 days to respond. And if they did not take care of the influenza virus within 3 days, you see that massive infection and death, okay? Now, you don't have 3 days worth of time to search sequence space of the CDRs. Because remember, no matter how many clones you have, the generation time of a mutation is 24 hours. So you got 3 days, three mutations, let's say, you just can't do it, right? And so there is probably a component of the immunological repertoire that is there to take care of viruses in general, to take care of influenza virus, and it was evolutionarily selected, and that's why everybody got the same antibody, regardless of the source. And now, courtesy of Ian and others, we have these wonderful structures of the stem of the influenza virus plus these antibodies. Needless to say, there's an enormous amount of activity going on to see if one can make a universal vaccine for influenza out of these regions. We can talk about it during the discussion. And finally, the final frontier. A true library means that all the works of man are therein contained. There is no such library in the literature, but if one wanted to, one could easily make such a library of antibodies. And the drill that is currently going on is this. You can't see the whole thing, but the concept is libraries against libraries. And what you do is you take a library, it doesn't matter which way you do it, except for certain nuances. You put all the antigens in the genome in yeast. You have a phage antibody library of about 10 to the 11th members. And then you basically allow them to interact with each other, and anybody, any yeast who's got a phage on it, that means there's an antigen antibody union there. And then you select it by cell sorting, and at the end of the day, what you have in a test tube is replicating antigen-antibody pairs. Either the yeast or the phage, depending which way you want to go, contain the antibody, and the other contains the antigen. And so there are places now, many places, who are doing that drill. And ultimately, if one can get global cooperation, there will be a library, and it will truly be the end of immunization, because you will isolate your antibodies by telephone rather than by rabbit. Now, as you might imagine, these libraries are being prepared, and the early focus is not against the antigen that might be of interest to you for staining certain regions of the brain, for instance, or certain objects of desire purely scientific, but the early libraries against libraries are to commercially important antigens. So there are those who are expressing every lymphokine, every cytokine, every this, every that, every tumor antigen one can get. But ultimately, and we hope to do much of this, there will be an antibody in a test tube to every antigen there is, many perhaps to some antigens, and also to different portions of the antigen. And this is just what the sorts look like. And so basically, in this particular region, that particular region of the sort are replicating antigen-antibody pairs that are now easily recovered. Who did all this? Well, the movie I showed you was about Paul Ehrlich. It's a wonderful movie. It's terrific for students, basically. It's called The Magic Bullet. It was made after the Second World War. It tells you things like, if you can imagine, there was a time when people said, can you imagine that these people want to use organic compounds in people? They have an idea that somebody's going to swallow an organic compound. You know, these are really crazy people. Those are like the people who didn't like libraries. Ehrlich, here, it was a John Huston movie, probably one of his biggest failures. And to some of you, not many, this is actually Edward G. Robinson, right? Played Ehrlich and Ruth Gordon, very famous, Mrs. Ehrlich and so on and so forth, right? It is truly a great movie for students because some of the concepts that they thought were difficult or impossible, the idea that they were difficult today seems laughable. And these are others who many of you know who have worked with me for years, particularly Peter Schultz and I have done a lot together. We didn't talk about much that Peter and I did. Carlos Barbas was very important in the early days of the libraries. He himself is a professor now. Terry Jones has been with me for a long time. And the flu antibodies were made together with a company at C-Lane called, particularly a man by the name of Ramesh Bhatt. Let me ask you to contemplate the difficulties of getting into Turkey and getting bone marrow from six children and getting back to a laboratory in the United States. Thank you for all your kindness to our traveling party, and very much appreciate your hospitality.